Hey everybody, welcome to the 45th episode of the JDO Show. I'm your host, J. David Osborne, a.k.a. Mr. Iron-On. How are you this, well, I guess it's Wednesday, you'll probably listen to it on Thursday. How are you this Thursday? Good? Thursdays are nice days, they're one day away from Friday, and then you can spend the whole weekend shooting heroin and screaming at babies, which is how I think most people spend their weekends. Today on the program, we have William Boyle. He's the author of Gravesend and Death Don't Have No Mercy. He's also one of the nicest people I know. We talk about France, which we've both been to, because we're very cultured, well-traveled adult males. We talk about Gravesend, and we talk about movies. I hope you enjoy this chat. I hope you are enjoying life in general. And I hope that you're not all fucked up. Don't be fucked up. It's going to be okay. If you are interested, I have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/jdavidosborne. If you'd like to contribute to the fund, I finally have a pretty cool job and got a lot of freelance work rolling in, but I'm going to be doing some really neat things with that Patreon, so check that out if you want to, or not. It's whatever. Don't matter. I just like making podcasts. All right, folks. I hope you enjoy this. I think I said that already, but I don't give a fuck. That's how little of a fuck I give. I'm so punk. I'm so goddamn punk. Enjoy this episode. Hey, man. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
How are things? Good?
Oh, yeah, pretty good. I just started a fire in my kitchen, but I'm good now.
Nice. Well, how did you manage to do that?
I don't know, man. I just I put the wrong burner on, and I had something else on the back burner. I was making pizza dough, right. And I had that on the back burner just to rise, and the bowl that was in just went up in flames for some reason.
Is that something you typically do? You make your own pizza dough?
I do, yeah. I'm from Brooklyn and I live in Mississippi, so I'm not getting pizza anywhere.
That's true. How long have you lived in Mississippi?
8 years. Yeah. 7-8 years.
So you like it okay?
Yeah, there's a lot I like about it.
I've never been to Oxford, but I hear it's a pretty sweet place. Have you ever been to Norman, Oklahoma?
I've not. No, I've been close to there. I think how far is Norman from like Fayetteville on the border? Is that pretty close? Fayetteville, Arkansas?
No, Norman's more, it's in the middle. It's a suburb of Oklahoma City. So.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I knew that. So I've never been there. I've only driven through Oklahoma. I've never spent any time there.
That's most people that I talk to, yeah. But no, it's kind of one of those things where, you know, it's a deeply, deeply red state and you drive through it. But when you get to Norman, it's this beautiful little pocket of, you know, cool coffee shops and nice bars and, you know, people who, a lot of like house shows and, you know, indie bands noodling with tons of guitar pedals and things like that.
Yeah. That's a lot what Oxford is like. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure different people have different experiences here. I didn't go to college here. You know, I don't know what that would be like, but the stuff that I know is great. You know, it's bookstore, record store, a lot of good music,
right.
Stuff like that. So.
Right. What brought you out there?
I came down here for, I wound up going to graduate school here, but I didn't have like a long list of places I wanted to go. I just, I knew I loved Larry Brown, and I loved a lot of music that was coming out on Fat Possum, and I just kind of wanted to get to Oxford.
Mm-hmm. Right on. And do you think that you'd ever, move anywhere else, or are you pretty stable there?
Oh yeah, no, we're not stable here at all. I'd move, you know, for the right reasons. I mean, we're kind of, it's because we have two kids now, it's kind of hard to imagine moving. Mm-hmm. Some days, but we'll eventually move. I don't see us really staying here, but I mean, we do like it here too, so if we stayed here, that'd be great.
How old are your kids?
6 and 2.
Six and two, right on. And as so if you don't, I guess some people get funny about this, but like, how old were you when you had your first kid?
32.
32. Okay, that's a good age. That's kind of like what Rios 32. And I are sort of thinking about too, because you know I'm 30, she's 29, and we're kind of like,
yeah,
you know, maybe now's a good time to do it. But did you feel like you were pretty much ready to have a kid when you had it, or was it like, oh shit?
Yeah, no, I think we felt ready at that point. I mean, we felt ready together. There's never, depending on what your situation's like for that, you know, there's never a good time for us in terms of like having enough money, or like we don't own a house, we don't, you know, we got a shitty old car, so we knew that was never probably, that wasn't changing anytime soon, you know, so it was, you know, but can't get worried about that stuff. I mean, so it was a good time for us.
Just got to jump off the cliff, basically.
Yeah, I mean, my wife and I have been together for 16 years or something, so.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, we just had our 10-year wedding anniversary, like, a few days ago. Yeah, no, it's pretty cool.
We just celebrated our 10-year, too.
Cool, cool, man. Yeah, no, so are you,
Well, you guys have been together for a while, right, since high school?
Oh, yeah, we got together when she was 15 and I was 16. And then we hit, you know, that, I don't know if this is true for you, but we hit that rough patch in the early 20s, right?
Yeah.
Where you kind of go, wow, well, wonder what else is out there. And then you kind of go your separate ways. We never got divorced, but we kind of went our separate ways. And then eventually, years later, we met up and we were just like, there's nothing else out there.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But I wanted to talk a little bit about France. Are you going to Lyon in March?
I'm not. No, I was at that one last year.
Mm-hmm.
They're not bringing me back for that one.
Is it because they hate your? They hate you over there, right?
No, I don't think they typically bring back the same people like year to year.
Uh-huh.
I think they switch things up pretty regularly. Like I know Megan Abbott's going back to this one, and she was there maybe like 5 years ago, 4 years ago or something.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I think they kind of, you know, it just depends on who's got books coming out and, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing.
So Gravesend is doing really well over there, right?
Yeah, as far as I can tell, it's been doing okay, which has been pretty amazing.
Now, when you went over there, were you kind of like this, you know, this specimen, right? Like this American writer? Did you feel like your Americanness when you were there?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to. I just feel, you know, I feel dumb, you know, because I can't speak French, but, and I felt dumb in other ways, but, so in that way, I guess I felt my Americanness.
Right.
But it was great. It was just, you know, Hind and Francois, and they were just so wonderful, and they just kind of took me around everywhere, and it was just, both times I was there were great experiences.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you went twice?
Yeah, so there was Lyon, and then I went back for the another festival in Saint-Malo, like right after it. One was in end of March, early April, and then they brought me back in May.
How much did you drink when you were there?
I mean, it was kind of perfect. I just drank nonstop, but I never was really drunk. I was just kind of drinking coffee and then just drinking wine all day, but just the perfect amount of wine, you know, spacing it out well. I don't know, it was just... Felt nonstop, but never got into a bad situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, for me it was when we went to Frontignan, which is, you know, a little town
on
the coast, and that town had their own particular wine that they made there.
Right.
They were super proud of it. And of course, you know, I'm there with, you know, these people who know what good wine is, and they're like, this wine is okay. It's an okay wine. And I'm like, I don't fucking know, dude. I went to my hotel room and there's a free bottle in there, like, looks good to me.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was as much as I wanted, and woo,
yeah.
One of those nights, I woke up the next day, I was there with Mark Haskell Smith.
Right,
he was like, you looked like death. Because I was sitting in a chair and I was holding onto the arm. I was just like completely wasted. And then, you know, the festival itself took place by this little old church, and there was no bathroom. There was just a bathroom, like a bus station bathroom. And I was just like, oh God, please, please don't shit your pants here. Like,
that's amazing. How long were you there?
I was there for 4 days. And nice. So, go ahead, sorry.
No, was it the festival the whole time, or were you in Paris too, or were you just in Frontignan?
Just Frontignan. I had a changeover in Paris, which was really interesting because I'm like you, I don't speak any French at all. And basically, when I got to the Paris airport, I had to get into a different line before I could go through security again to get a different ticket. And so the layover was pretty short. It was like an hour and 10 minutes or something like that.
Oh, wow.
And I get there and I get off the plane and I'm like, okay, this is totally fine. This is totally cool. And I'm going around asking people in English, like a fucking asshole, like, where do I go? I need a ticket to, and they're like, go stand in this line. And I'm standing in this line and I stood there for like 45 minutes and I'm watching the clock tick down. And I was about to have a fucking panic attack because I was like, if this doesn't work, I'm going to miss this flight. And so I almost had a breakdown in there. Like at one point I hopped over the little turnstile and cut everybody and jumped up and I was, is this how I get my ticket to Frontignan? And they were like, yeah, get back in line. I was like, okay. But overall it was pretty great. I mean, so did you get to go sightseeing in Lyon, or were you tied to a table?
No, it was pretty busy. There was a lot of stuff going on, and it was, you know, it was 3 days. I can't remember now. So it wasn't that long of a time because I was in Paris for a little while too. And then we took the train to Lyon and, it was, you know, I had an hour here, 2 hours there where I just kind of wandered around or, you know, but mostly I was just kind of, even my free time was staying close to the festival because there were people I wanted to meet and talk to, and I just wanted to, you know, do as much as I could.
Who all did you meet?
Richard Price was there.
Whoa.
That was a big one. I was on a panel with Richard Price, which was fucking
dude.
Amazing. And then Sarah Gran, whose books I love, she was there.
Mm-hmm. I like Sarah Gran as well. I like the Claire DeWitt books are really good.
Yeah, I love the Claire DeWitt books. I was excited, and I got to Richard Price. I mean, I met him, got to say hello to him, and was on this panel with him. But beyond that, I was pretty nervous. I didn't really get to talk to him too much. But Sarah Gran, I got to hang out with and talk to a lot, which was great. James Grady, who's published by Rivage. He was great. He kind of took me under his wing and showed me around. He wrote 3 Days of the Condor.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Which the book is maybe 6 Days of the Condor, but the movie is 3 Days of the Condor.
Right. Right. Because they only have half the time for the movie.
Yeah. Right. So he was great. And there were a ton of other people there. I didn't even get David Peace was there. David Peace is Rivage, and so he was everywhere. Everywhere that I went was with Francois and David Peace, basically.
Is he super nice? Because whenever I read books and it's all like, you know, the shit in the gutter and everybody's fucking dying and they, you know, I always assume those people are really nice.
Yeah, he was really nice. he was wonderful. And so basically it was, you know, David Peace, James Grady and me, I think, were the three writers from Rivage. So that was like, you know, every meal we were all together. You know, people from Rivage, like Francois and Jean and Hind and those and us three writers. So it was great.
So I saw this thing on the internet, and explain this to me. So your next book is going to be through Gallmeister, but Francois is working. It's very strange to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't really know. I'm glad that article came out, because I didn't really know what was out there and what people kind of knew about yet.
Mm-hmm.
Francois is, I mean, I guess he's kind of, and I still don't really know what I can say or not say. Mm-hmm. Not to sound like I have some information that I just don't. I don't have a lot of information.
Uh-huh.
But the little that I do have, I'm not sure what's out there yet.
Right. Okay.
So he's basically retired from Rivage but he's staying on with the authors, with his big authors at Rivage, like Elroy and Lehane and
you.
Those guys are staying with Rivage.
Oh, with Rivage. Like, okay, I see.
Yeah, Elroy, Lehane, David Peace. There might be another one or two. And Francois is still going to be their kind of go-between and still work with them. And Rivage, I guess. But on the whole, he's moving on to Gallmeister, and he's going to have this kind of advisory role at Gallmeister and be working with Gallmeister. So he's brought me along for that.
Very interesting. Yeah, when I was in Frontignan, everybody would, you know, they'd meet me and they'd say, oh, hello, you know, nice to meet you. And then we would get to talking and they would say, so you publish books also? And I say, yeah, I put out William Boyle's Gravesend. And they would just get this look on their face. They'd be like, you put out that book is amazing, you know. It was super cool, man. And like, it's funny because Francois told me that he had a lunch or something with the Gallmeister guy, and the Gallmeister said, "I knew it was you. I knew you were the son of a bitch who got Gravesend."
Yeah.
So they were fighting over your book, dude. How fucking killer is that, man?
I mean, it was amazing. I couldn't really believe any of that. I mean, it was easy to convince myself that when I was over there. Right. A lot of people were like asking to take pictures with me and shit, and a lot of people thought I was. There's a writer named William Boyd.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Who I've never read. He's a British writer, and then there's T.C. Boyle. So I think a lot of people thought I was one of those two guys.
No, I don't think so, dude. I think you're actually. I don't think you understand, man. Because when I was there, most of the conversations that I had with people were about Gravesend. And how awesome Gravesend was.
Oh, thanks. So, that's good to hear, man. Thank you.
Yeah.
No, and thank you for all you've done to make it happen and to bring it into the
kicking and screaming, fucking up every inch of the way, and then, you know, you lucked into working with some fucking pros, man. But yeah, no, so that's really cool. Has anybody talked to you about like movie stuff or anything? I guess I don't know if you really talk about that, but
I love movies, so you know I'm really always influenced by what I'm watching. There's a director who got in touch with me pretty early on, and he's kind of stayed in touch with me, but you know, that's the way things go in that world. It seems like people kind of, you know, it might be a couple of years or a few years, or things kind of nothing happens. And but he's still interested in it. He's a good guy, and I like what he's done. So we'll see if anything ever comes of it.
Should talk to James Gray.
Yeah, I mean, I wish.
I mean, it feels like, doesn't Gravesend feel like Little Odessa, right? Like it's kind
of. Yeah, man. I mean, that's, you know, that's one of my big influences for sure. That was a movie came out when I was in high school, and I'd never seen, you know, Brooklyn that I recognized really in that way. Mm-hmm. I love James Gray. So.
So you were born and raised.
Yeah.
And you were in Gravesend.
Yeah, all my family's still little is left in my family. My mom and my grandmother are still there. Yeah, so great. I kind of, the neighborhood where I grew up is kind of the edge of Gravesend, but it's also like I spent a lot of my time in Bensonhurst and this neighborhood called Bath Beach. These kind of three neighborhoods that are all close together in South Brooklyn, near not far from Coney Island. So for the purpose of the book, I just kind of made it all Gravesend because, you know, I like that word. I've always liked that word. I always wanted to call a book Gravesend. I didn't want to call it Bensonhurst. But I kind of grew up between those three neighborhoods. I went to high school in Bay Ridge, which is in the book too. So, I mean, you know, not that much of the book, actually, if you think about it, actually takes place in the neighborhood of Gravesend, but that's where their houses are. That's where they grew up. That's where their families are, you know, so, and they bring that place with them. So, I'm from there. I spent my whole childhood there. I went to college in, upstate New York, but, mostly in Brooklyn before here.
Right on, right on. And so what made you want to, what, actually, you know what's so funny, man, is that this is, for the most part, it's more of like a conversational kind of thing, but I actually am interested, though, like, in like some kind of bookish question, so I hope you don't mind. But,
no, man, that's great.
But like,
I've been loving the podcast. But
oh, thank you.
Listening to it a lot lately. Man.
Thank you very much. Yeah. But like, so where did this come from? Okay, so like, where basically did Gravesend come from?
You know, I don't know. I don't remember now. Sort of in some ways. I mean, I knew I had the Conway Ray Boy story. I started there, you know, so, I mean, I guess I do know. I mean, there was, when I was back in New York in, I guess, 2006 to 2008, I was living in the Bronx. My wife's family's from the Bronx. And, there was a story that I read about, a case, this guy, Michael Sandy, is very much the inspiration for what happens to Duncan in the book. And this kid who was a student at the SUNY Maritime in the Bronx was one of the kids who was responsible for Michael Sandy. Dying basically. The what happens to Duncan is, like I said, modeled pretty much exactly on what happens to Michael Sandy. So I knew I wanted to start with this kind of hate crime and have it, you know, be Conway, the brother who's left, and the other guy getting out of prison. And I knew I wanted to have this kind of noir, classic noir beginning of the guy getting out of prison, the other guy going after him. I think I'd just watched, not long before the starting writing at this old noir called Act of Violence. So I knew I had that kind of set up in mind. And I think I wrote the first chapter. It took me a while to write the first chapter. But the rest kind of just changed over time. My initial idea for the book was to bounce back and forth between the events in 1994 and the present. And then I realized that, you know, we already knew what happened in 1994. And there was kind of all the tension would be gone from those parts if I did that. And so I just started to write. And I had no plans for Alessandra or Eugene. Those characters just kind of showed up and took over the book. And I knew I wanted to write about the neighborhood, my neighborhood. So I had this kind of like, you know, Robert Altman inspired vision of my neighborhood, of these kind of all these moving parts and how these different characters take the neighborhood and the mythology of the neighborhood with them everywhere, and how, you know, it changes them and ruins them and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not exactly a feel good book, I would say. Pretty much every character meets some kind of either grim or, well, we'll just say grim. Grim is a good word for pretty much what happens to everybody, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. It's about doom, you know. It's a doomed neighborhood and doomed characters.
You seem like a pretty like laid back dude, though, right?
Like, I try in my life to be, you know, I gotta, but I mean, yeah, I've got dark shit, you know, like anybody, I guess. And
sure. Yeah.
Have gone to some dark places. But you know, I try to,
you know, people are very accepting of furries now. Like, you don't have to hide that in the closet anymore. You can be your foxkin and your fur self and all that. I mean, nobody's really going to judge you. Nobody's going to judge you. Man, that would be great to have a fucking like a bank robbery book, like a heist book where it's all furries, right?
That is a good idea, man. You should do that one.
But they relate to it, like they relate to each other as animals, right?
Yeah.
So they have to like make these plans and like, you know, that would be, those things are so like, God bless those people, but man, those fucking furries are creepy as shit. Like,
yeah, I mean, that really, I'm not even kidding. That would be a really good setup for a crime story.
Yeah, I wonder what. Yeah,
I mean, it is, because it is inherently weird and creepy, which is just, you know,
Yeah.
It's great to have that all set up for you.
You could just call it Foxkin.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it reminds me. Did you see Witching and Bitching?
No, I don't even know what that is.
Oh, it's the Alex de la Iglesias, guy who did Perdita Durango and The Last Circus. You seen any of these movies?
Oh yeah, yeah. I've seen Perdita Durango.
Yeah, well, it's his new movie, and it's sort of this crime comedy, really, really well done, about a group of bank robbers. I think it's a jewelry heist. Anyway, they camp out in a backwoods Spanish town, and there's witches there, basically. And
man, that sounds good.
Super campy, super good. But yeah, the opening scene is like they're doing this jewel heist, and one guy is dressed as Jesus Christ and another guy is dressed up as SpongeBob SquarePants, and so it's really cool to see like SpongeBob SquarePants get machine gunned to death.
Is this available, pretty widely available?
Yeah, it's on Netflix. I watched it. Yeah. I also watched this movie.
I'm gonna watch it tonight.
I watched this movie that somebody recommended it to me. It's called Cheap Thrills.
I've heard of that. I haven't watched it.
That one's good too, man. I've been watching a lot of these really interesting sort of indie crime movies are kind of popping up all over the place.
Nice.
I sort of just follow Jed, whatever Jed says, because that guy watches eight movies a day. So like, I just assume.
Did you watch Too Late?
No.
Jed and I were talking about that one.
It's
John Hawks. It's this new director. It's his first movie. It's very like Tarantino-ish, but not in a rip-off way. Much more in like an homage kind of way. But John Hawks is so good in it, and I think it's been a little while since I watched it now. It's five parts, I think, five chapters, and they're all a single take, so they're all like 22, 23 minutes.
Whoa.
So it's got this, it's like the beginning of De Palma's Snake Eyes. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I have, yes.
Which the beginning is the best part. It's fucking great, you know, that opening 20-minute shot or whatever.
Right.
So it's like five things like that. First one's pretty bad. I mean, it's you know, if you can make, I've recommended it to people and they've bailed on it. In the first 15, 20 minutes. If you can make it to when John Hawks comes in, it gets really good. I watched it a couple of times because I had pretty mixed feelings about it. I think Jed was in the same boat. We talked about it almost immediately. I think he watched it somehow the same day or same week that I watched it. And it's worth watching, though.
I think, yeah, no, that kind of, like, when I talked to Jed and Johnny Shaw, we talked about, and David Keaton, too, we talked about almost good movies, which is sort of a thread through the first few podcasts. And, yeah, it's like, it's the kind of movies that you're talking about, this Too Late movie, where it makes you, you engage with it more because it's so imperfect, right? And that's a problem that I've been having. Everybody tells me, you know, that Hell or High Water is really good, but it looks too good. If that makes any sense, right?
Looks
like I'd sit down. I know I'm gonna feel a certain way. Maybe that's what it is too, man. It's like, I know that when I sit down to watch Hell or High Water, I'm gonna leave that feeling a certain way and having a certain thing done to my psyche. And something with movies like, you know, Too Late or Witching and Bitching, where you don't really know what you're gonna get. That's maybe more exciting.
Yeah, it is. It's a little bit more. I mean, for me, it duplicates a lot more of, you know, how I started watching movies and falling in love with movies, just, you know, going to the video store and picking something out because I thought it looked cool, or, you know, I didn't know anything about anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I like that feeling. It doesn't happen that often anymore, you know, because I'm mostly watching stuff that people tell me to watch, or I know I like the director or the writer or the actors or whatever. That's Too Late was. I mean, that's not totally true because I watched Too Late mainly because I love John Hawks, but it did have that quality for me, not knowing what I was getting into at all.
Now, you're a big music guy, though, right? So you're kind of a huge music nerd.
Yeah, music, movies, books, all of it, really. But they're always kind of always going back and forth between the three.
Now, do you get the same feeling with music that you do with movies? That there, you know, do you have trouble finding that initial youthful feeling of, you know? Is there stuff that's still doing that to you with music?
Yeah, for sure. No, I don't have that at all with music, really. I work in a record store here a couple of days a week, and which is great because I get kind of some exposure to stuff I might not hear otherwise. But there's stuff that's pretty constantly surprising me. And this record, this girl, Julian Baker from Memphis, she's like 19, 20. She put out a record last year called Sprained Ankle that it was that exactly. Like, you know, she was just a kid I'd never heard of. And then I was listening to her record and it was fucking great. Best thing I'd heard in years. So it happens, you know.
And is there something too with music, like we were talking about with movies? Is it, now with this Julian Baker record, is it perfect, or is one of the reasons why you like it because it feels maybe a little bit more, I don't know if organic is the right word, right? But like unpolished, maybe.
Yeah, raw, unpolished. Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's something that quality of other hands not getting into it, not ruining it at all is definitely good. And I think you're actually probably more likely to find that in music than in books or movies.
Right. And I agree with that. And it's because with books especially, there's this weird catch-22 where if a book isn't quote-unquote well-written, whatever that means, right, we tend to be like, oh, this is crap, we throw it away. But then, you know, it's also kind of boring when you can tell people have gone through the same MFA programs. They're writing the same sentences, exactly. Right?
And manufactured, and yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And like doing the freelance stuff, I've talked about this a little bit on the podcast, but you know, I edited this Christian memoir from this Korean woman. And it's just basically about her journey from a small town in Korea to owning.
Wait, what's her name? That was, Not Jeannie Kang, is it?
Oh no, that's right. You sent her my way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. She's from Mississippi. That's
so great, man. Yeah. No, it's so funny. I'm talking to you like you don't know what the fuck I'm talking about.
I'd forgotten about that.
But I read. Yeah. So I worked on it. It's Miguk is what it's called. And like when you first start it, you know, you're kind of like, oh God, here we go. You know, this is going to take some work or whatever. But then what's so interesting is that you fall into like the rhythm of it. And by the end of that book, there's no reason looking at like what I do on Broken River, what I write or what I typically like, that I would have really loved that book. But I do. Like, I genuinely enjoyed that book.
Yeah. And, there's some great stuff in there.
And it's so funny, but because I guess my point is that like, I don't know how I would have found that on a bookstore shelf. Right. And that's like a failing of mine. Right.
Yeah, no.
But I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to agree with you.
Yeah. So
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, so I guess, is there anything that you've read recently that you would say falls into that category? Do you push through with books?
Yeah, I do. I mean, you know, I've been actually, I had a real bad stretch kind of late fall into the winter. It lasted for a while where I was just, and this will happen to me every once in a while, where I was just picking up even stuff I loved or had read before and loved or knew I would love. I was picking it up and just putting it down after a couple of pages and not able to keep my head in it. So I had a bad reading stretch there for a little while. And then I read Atticus Lish's Preparation for the Next Life finally, which I've been meaning to read for
good
a while.
Good book, man.
And that book took me out of it. That book blew me away. Mm-hmm. So that was great. And now I'm reading, which I feel kind of embarrassed that I haven't read this already, but I'm finally getting around to reading 2666, and I'm totally just absorbed by it.
Where are you at in it?
I'm like 300 pages in. So I'm in part three.
That's the noir one.
Yeah, it's so fucking good.
Yeah. It gets, part four is a little difficult, but you'll power through. And then part five is just going to fucking make the floor drop out. Like, it's really
good. I can't wait, man.
It's so good, man. Yeah.
I sound stupid saying this, but I don't often love long novels. Mm-hmm. But this one is, I mean, it's fucking incredible.
Right on. Now, do you follow the political situation, or are you kind of hands off with it, or what?
Yeah. No, I follow it, man. It's, you know, it's hard. It's hard not to, especially, I mean, you know, where I am, I'm kind of, you know, deep in this in Mississippi. So
What's the attitude there?
You know, again, I have a circle of people here that I'm friends with that, you know, for the most part are musicians and writers and teachers and, you know, people who own small businesses, and their attitudes pretty much align with mine. But this is, you know, it's very much like a lot of, you know, SUVs with Trump upper stickers and shit like that. So it's, you know, it's Mississippi. It's what you need. Sorry.
That's okay. Did you tear out your headphones or something?
Yeah. Still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, it's, I'm really where we're at now. I just can't really wrap my head around. In some ways, I'm trying to just throw myself into work and writing and reading and watching and listening and those things that I fall back on. But it's hard not to think about how fucked up everything is.
Do you have any friends, buddies, people that you know that you've talked to who voted for Trump?
You know, definitely. I don't really can't think of any. Yeah, I know. I know people who have, for sure. I mean, mostly kind of people on the edges of the family. But you know, a lot of those people are New Yorkers, and they're not, you know, I'm seeing them when I go back for Christmas or something. And, you know, I'm not starting a conversation with them really. Mm-hmm. So I didn't, you know, and they're not the kind of people who were very in your face about it. So, you know, I don't know. I certainly don't have a lot of people that I'm very close to that I know that voted for Trump. Although, I mean, I'm surrounded by it here. I'm sure have, you know, a lot of these kids around here did, you know. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I'm very even in this climate, it's very hard for me to talk politics with people. I just kind of get very, I don't know, nervous to
nervous,
talk
really?
To people. But,
well,
yeah,
we'll talk about that. Like, where does that come from? Like, what makes you nervous about? Like, you think they're gonna like shoot you or something? Or
no, not that. I mean, I guess I'm just kind of, you know, I'm always been kind of non-confrontational about. I don't like those sorts of confrontations, and I never have talking about getting in arguments with people about politics and religion. So I kind of try to, you know, it's harder now because it feels like you're confronted with it more than maybe usual. But yeah, I try not to, you know, get in arguments with people, basically.
It's so interesting that you said that you have relatives in New York, because that kind of blows my mind, because, I mean, they've known about Trump for probably most of their lives.
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, it's just crazy. I mean, it definitely, I think, on that side, comes down to more of just hating liberals thing.
Mm, mm.
I don't know. I mean, I think that, but although, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of people, again, in New York too, that I've seen be more enthusiastic about him than I've seen them ever be enthusiastic about any Republican. So there's something that's kind of clicked on in people.
Well, yeah, I think when you said that there's like a hatred of liberals, that's a big point, because a lot of what I see, and, you know, I was talking to Scott Adlerberg about this, because I went to Twitter, and for about an hour I just looked at, you know, Trump supporters on Twitter. And he said, well, David, you know, you went to Twitter, so...
Yeah.
But, okay, so but if we were to humor it and just kind of take it as a sample size, the majority of what people say on that side is, ha-ha, you are all a bunch of pussies, we won.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really go much deeper than that. You know,
that's it, basically.
If anybody brings up any kind of policy, whatever, their tactic, this is what my dad does too. Their tactic is to just say, no, that's not true, right?
Yeah, and turn to abortion. Abortion is like their go-to.
Right.
Like, well, there's abortion, you know.
Yeah.
You guys are cool with killing babies. That's it.
Well, I'm very cool with it. I'm totally fine with it. Yeah, I'm actually for it.
That's it. They got a couple of notes in the playbook.
Yeah, and it really, you know, I wish there's obviously there's tons of people in this country, and you know, it's so complicated. I mean, you'd need a supercomputer to really make sense out of all of it. But when you kind of look at the other side, but you know, I mean, to be fair, when you look at the left side too, you do have a lot of like people with their heads up their ass. And you know, there's a post that I saw recently where it was like, I'm an atheist bisexual PhD and I'm here for the resistance. And it's like, oh well, thank you so much for being you, you know. I appreciate that. So I do think that the right is very annoyed with the left, and the left is really good about being super annoying.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw somebody that, you know, that writer Matt Bell.
Yeah.
He posted something on Facebook yesterday that was just, or yesterday, the day before, that was something like, Jesus Christ, why are liberals the hardest people in the world to just agree with?
Right.
You can't even agree with them like without it being a thing.
Right, right. Yeah, no, and that's totally true. And what's so funny is that that's coming from Matt Bell, who's like one of the nicest people probably in books, right? Like everybody likes. So if Matt Bell is just saying, Jesus Christ, people, like, I mean, you know you've got a problem at that point, right?
Yeah.
But I had a question earlier. Like, you don't have an accent. Where's your accent?
I don't know, man. I had one. You can. There are tapes of me from when I was growing up, but I didn't lose it. I lost it, you know. By the time I was 18, living in upstate New York, I kind of shed it. I probably was pretty self-conscious about it, you know, I don't know. I just didn't. I didn't talk that much, I guess, growing up either. So.
And so you were kind of a shy kid.
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty quiet, pretty shy. And by high school, I was mostly, you know, I was mostly just interested in watching movies and reading books. By the time I was 18, got to college, I kind of just lost the accent.
Oh, right on. Yeah, no, I think that, that's kind of interesting because I get that a lot too. Every once in a while, a little bit of Oklahoma will come out, but for the most part, I have a pretty middle of the road sort of voice, right? But I do wonder if like watching a lot of movies changes people's act. Because if, you know, you're a sponge, right? And you take whatever is around you, and that's what your accent becomes. So maybe if you watch just a ton of movies, you get this kind of flat, like just completely middle of the road.
Newscaster kind of. Yeah.
Whoa. I think we just solved it. We should be fucking anthropologists, dude.
Yeah, man, we should.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, I don't know. I just lost it. I don't know. I'm also not. I don't know. Like my kids, I don't know if they're gonna have Southern accents. I don't know. My kids are kind of a mess right now. They say some things like they're from the South, and some things like they're from New York. So we'll see. I don't know how any of that works.
Yeah, no, because like you talk to somebody like Scott Adlerberg, and it's very clear where he's from.
Yeah,
like there's no mistaking that, right?
Yeah, no. And my mom's got a heavy accent, but she also, you know, she's 62 and she's been in the neighborhood her whole life and lived on the same block her whole life. Right. So she's got a very specific accent to the neighborhood. I grew up there. I was there for 18 years, but then I lived upstate New York for 5 years, Texas for a year, back to upstate New York, the Bronx, back to Brooklyn, Mississippi. So, I think accents have to do with staying in a place to a certain extent.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I think I'm going to be in Brooklyn in like 2 weeks.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I'm going to be house-sitting for Scott for a couple of weeks.
Oh, nice.
So
awesome.
If you got any recommendations about cool places that I got to visit, then I will check those out.
Yeah, man, I can. Well, you know, you'll probably know a lot of the places in downtown in the city. And so, where's Scott live again?
He lives in Bed-Stuy.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you want places in my neighborhood, mostly it just revolves around food.
Right. Yeah, no. Pizza. The thing that blew my mind when I went to New York for the very first time was I went out and I got shithoused, right?
Yeah.
I was hanging out with buddies and, you know, got drunk and then left. And I forgot to pee before I left. And we had a long train ride to get back to where we were staying. And holy shit, there's like no bathrooms anywhere. Like, you are fucked.
Yeah, I know.
Like, once you get on that thing, you are fucked. You better not have to pee unless you want to put a catheter in, dude. But that was like, that was actually the worst it's ever been. You know, there's that woman who, remember the hold your wee for a wee thing where she drank like a gallon of water. Who could hold it the longest?
Oh yeah.
You win a wee, and then that lady died from it. Like, I thought I was gonna die. Like, my back teeth were floating. It's crazy.
Yeah, it happens, man. You gotta be careful.
So what's on the horizon for you, writing wise?
I don't know. I'm working on a new book that I'm kind of. I messed up the first draft of it, so I'm kind of tearing it down and just fixing the second half, so we'll see. Mm-hmm. Got a couple other short things I've finished in the last year and a half, but nothing big outside of, you know, the France stuff and the UK stuff that we talked about.
Yeah, so that's really cool. Wait, can we talk about that, or is that
I don't know. Maybe not
it gets weird, right? Like
it does. Yeah, I don't know. I guess not officially yet. No.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm sorry I brought it up.
No, that's fine. But it's so funny too, because you get to a point and you never want to be that guy, right? You know, I can't.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. It's super,
I don't want to sound like a dick either. Like, oh, I can't talk about that. I don't know. Like, I mostly don't want to jinx myself and like.
Right. You know, right.
Fuck things up.
That's
for
super,
myself,
super
yeah.
important. Yeah, now whenever I get really good news, I don't do anything, dude. I don't vague book about it. I don't tell anybody.
No.
You know, I just the last few pieces of good information I've gotten, I haven't even told Rios. I'm just like, this stays in my heart. You know, like
yeah, that's the way to go, man. That's all I can do.
I don't know, man. I'm a little super. Are you superstitious at all?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, about weird things, like numbers, and I mean, I don't know if that's superstition or more like OCD. Like, I like the number four, so I like to do things four times, or you know, something like that.
Multiples of four, or
yeah, multiples of four.
See, yeah, that's my thing too, dude. It's multiple. What do I normally go to? There are just certain numbers that I stay. We're weird about 13, right? So you know, if I do something 9 times and then I do the other thing 4 times, I have to do one more to get to 14 total.
Yeah.
I've gotten it under control pretty well. It's, you know, it's that itch in the brain. I actually got a book on it's OCD is what it is. So, you know, it's but you know, you think that if you land on 13 that, you know, your fucking whole family is going to die in a fire or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
But
yeah, very, very much like that too.
Yeah. And so you just kind of like, basically in this book, the whole strategy is to just, the guy's like, you just have to let it happen. it's just exposure therapy, basically. You have to just be like, all right, well, if that happens, that happens, right?
Yeah.
But it depends for me. Like, if I have just smoked a cigarette, it's really bad. Something with nicotine, caffeine does it to me. I think a lot of writers have that, which is very strange.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a lot of people I know have it, for sure. Mm-hmm.
My little brother, he was doing his PhD, and one of the, I think his thesis was about OCD, because he has it too, and he connected it to people who grow up very, very religious, but then leave the church. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, so they still have to have that kind of, like...
That ritual, kind of...
Yeah, like, ritual and, like, something looking over you, and, you know, you have to do this in order to get that, and blah, blah, blah. And...
Could be. I mean, I definitely, you know, I mean, I didn't grow up in, what you would think of as, like, a super religious household, but I grew up very Catholic, you know, going to church all the time and stuff, and there's definitely a lot of ritual that comes with that.
When did you quit going to church?
You know, I've kind of had a complicated relationship with that throughout my life. I guess I stopped when I went to college, mm-hmm. but I'd been in high school, I had at least a year or two where I got really into it. Would go to church like every day. And then when I got to college, I broke hard away from it. Mm-hmm. And then stayed away from it for a while. Came back for a couple of years in my late 20s, and then broke harder than ever away from it after that.
Do you remember what did it? Was it something happen, or was it just reading books, or what?
It's basically like, you know, I mean, if I'm reading, which is why I still have a complicated relationship with it. If I'm reading something or watching something that moves me in that way, like when I, you know, as a teenager, it was reading the, you know, Kerouac and stuff like that. Kerouac, you know, really devout Catholic, and I think that kind of made it cool to me when mm-hmm. I was in high school. And then, you know, later it was like, you know, watching things like The Passion of Joan of Arc and Robert Bresson's movies and stuff like that, really. And reading, I got really into reading Catholic mysticism, like St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila. And that stuff, I mean, I love that stuff. It really moves me. And you know, that kind of brought me back in to a certain extent. You know, I think there was, when I was living in this town upstate New York called New Paltz, there was I kind of tried on going back to church, and there was a priest there that I really liked. He was a Jesuit, so he was kind of like a old hippie priest, and he was great. He was everything I liked about the church without any of the bad stuff. But then I came, actually probably when I came to Mississippi, and I think we went to church here once or twice, and went to a Catholic church, and I was like, oh, I remember everything I hate. Mm-hmm, I remember why I don't do this.
Now, what is the Christian mysticism? What does that mean?
Just you know, like there's a whole kind of I don't know, subcategory of Christian writing, just about very kind of internal, personal, mystical, almost like druggy interactions with God, where these writers have kind of conversations with God and struggle with faith and doubt. And mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. a lot of really, The Cloud of Unknowing is another one I really love. It's been a while since I've read some of that, so I'm not gonna sound really good talking about a lot of it.
Right, but right. No, it's funny that you mentioned like the drug thing. I heard somewhere that, you know, the burning bush, right? There's like a theory that most of the plants that were the bushes that would have been in this area at that time were acacia trees, and right. Those are really, really high in DMT. So it was burning, it would be vaporized DMT, right? So the burning bush well might have spoken. There's a Jesuit guy who I just read, Anthony DeMello. You ever read any of his work?
No, I haven't, no.
The really good, small, tiny, tiny book called The Way to Love. And I'm all about whatever works. I'm not a hard one.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I actually believe in God. I'm not an atheist.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not a Christian either, right? I don't have any of that. So I like whatever works, man, you know?
Yeah, me too. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I like Barry Hanna, who's one of my favorite writers, used to call himself a Baptist atheist. And I think Robert Bresson has actually said that too, that he was a Christian agnostic. Mm-hmm. I sometimes feel like a Catholic agnostic. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've definitely had times probably in my life when I would call myself an atheist, but I don't generally latch onto that term mm-hmm. too much. But yeah, I'm with you on that for sure.
Yeah, and I think that there's a reason why people who become atheists tend to become militant about it, right? And it's one of those kind of like the lady doth protest too much kind of things, where it's my opinion that there's something there and we can all kind of feel it, and you could say no, there's nothing, only, you know, scientific materialism, what I can see in front of my face, that's it. But it's kind of like, I mean, of course, there are also evangelical Christians who are obnoxious, but you know, anytime you have somebody who's just so adamant about something not being true.
Yeah, no, you got to be. I mean, whatever your stance. I mean, I think what's important is the ability to accept mystery, some kind of mystery.
Oh, for sure.
You know, because there's mystery. I mean, there's no getting around that. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of like what writing is all about, right? Like, it's just about the best writing is that weird, paradoxical stuff, like following characters that don't make any sense. You know, we naturally want to find patterns and make sense of things, but the best art makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, for sure.
It's just like, why would anybody do that? Well, that is a great note to end it on. I feel like I'm on a New York subway because my back teeth are floating again. So I'm going to let you go, sir. Thank you so much for being on my podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much for talking to me, man. Thank you for everything. It's always great getting to talk to you, and I've been loving the podcast. And
sweet. Thanks. Yeah, no problem, buddy. All right, I'll talk to you soon.
All right, man. Take care.
All right, bye-bye.